From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In the old movies, Wizard of Oz and all the rest, when the big twister comes, Auntie Em and the family hustle into the old underground storm shelter out back and ride out the storm. When the giant tornado hit Moore, Oklahoma this week, a lot of people had nowhere to hide. No storm shelter, even in schools where children died. This hour on Point, Oklahoma's giant twister and whether Tornado Alley needs to change the way it builds in the face of big, big storms. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation never ends. Should shelters and reinforced construction be mandatory in Tornado Alley? Or are the costs too high and the odds too long of being hit? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We're just coming in today that the mayor of Moore, Oklahoma, is saying that he's going to propose an ordinance in the next couple of days that would require construction of reinforced shelters in every new home in that town of 56,000. A huge tornado, of course, there this week, and it's not the first time. Yesterday, talking with the BBC, Betsy Randolph of Oklahoma Highway Patrol said that those who live in tornado country, for people there, one of the hardest things to accept is the death and injury of children seeking shelter inside their schools.
We trust that when we take our kids to school in the morning, that when we drop them off, that they're going to be there. And it's heartbreaking when they're not. And I don't have the answer. We trust that God watches over our families. And we have to hope that when we come home at the end of the day, that our house is going to be there.
Hope. But, of course, many houses were not there in Moore, Oklahoma this week. And people are thinking about, in an era of big storms on the coast or here, well inland in Tornado Alley, if there's more that might be done. Joining me first today from Oklahoma City is Heidi Brandis. She's a reporter covering Monday's big tornado and its aftermath for the Wall Street Journal. She was editor of the Moore American, the newspaper, when the huge 1999 tornado hit town. Heidi, welcome to On Point. Thanks very much for being here.
Hi, Tom.
So, I guess we're through the phase of looking for people, or are they still searching for people who may be trapped under rubble in Moore, Heidi?
Well, you know, search and rescue is ongoing. It was ongoing as soon as the twister went through the town Monday night. And according to the Moore Fire Chief, Gary Bird, they were doing, you know, second, third, even fourth sweeps of every structure, every building, every overturned car looking for possible survivors, and they were supposed to complete that by Tuesday night, and they have. And so right now begins the process of cleaning up.
It's overwhelming.
We see huge job.
Absolutely huge. The images are absolutely overwhelming. The whole country is just riveted on the scale of this tornado, though it's not the biggest Moore has faced, and the ferocity of it, the width and the depth and length of this thing. And at where the fatalities came, including some in school. What happened in school that left school children dead, Heidi?
Well, it took a direct hit. I mean, it was almost ground zero for an F5 tornado. And, you know, you can have reinforced walls, you can have brick, you can have inside, you know, closets in which to hide. But when you get hit straight on by something with 200 plus mile an hour winds, very little can stand up to it. I understand that some of the schools in Moore do have storm shelters in their facilities. There was funding after the 1999 tornado to install those, but there wasn't enough funding to install them in all the schools. And unfortunately, Plaza Towers was one of those that did not have the tornado-safe structure inside the building. So,
nine school children died. Were they all at Plaza Towers? I should know this, Heidi, but please clarify.
Yes, they were.
And Plaza Towers, that is the school. And what happened there? Was it roof collapse? We were drowning at one point? Many stories came out that I want to clarify.
Yeah, there was a lot of rumor that the kids were all in a basement and a water pipe broke and they all drowned, but that school does not have a basement.
Okay.
Basically, it was just being demolished. I mean, you've got debris, you've got roofs coming down, you've got walls coming apart, and just what kills most people in tornadoes, and this may not be the case inside the school, is flying debris. I mean, you've got wood flying at 200 miles an hour, you've got cars, building siding, roofs. And a lot of people are injured and killed by flying debris in tornado situations.
Of course, it really hurts here that this was not a school with a shelter that was strengthened specifically for that, and now those children are dead. Heidi, stand by. I've got calls coming in already from Oklahoma, and I want to get them on. Tracy calling from Oklahoma City. Tracy, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, yes. I just want to let everybody know out there that this is a conversation, obviously, we're having constantly right now in Oklahoma. I live in Oklahoma City. My husband was huddled with his students not far from the tornado, but fortunately not directly where it hit. And, you know, when I was growing up, I mean, I was one of those kids huddled against the wall in my school, and we felt safe in an interior closet or bathroom or in an underground area, not necessarily a shelter.
Yeah.
But with these F5s, like this tornado and the one in 99 and more, I mean, they kind of had a little bit more of a heads up. But, you know, reinforced buildings are great, but as you can see from the damage, I mean, you really have to be in underground in a storm shelter or just be gone.
I mean, there are some places where the house is going to go away, and we saw that. Do you think, Tracy, you're there in Oklahoma City, do you think people are willing to invest the resources in strengthening construction when you never know where the next tornado is going to hit and you can think, well, let's just pray it doesn't hit here?
I do think it's quite possible people are now ready to do that. I know growing up, you know, we had, you know, F2s, F3s, you know, and you kind of do have a sense of, get a bathroom with a mattress over your head, you're probably going to be fine, just hope to God it doesn't hit you.
Mm-hmm.
But with those school children, I just think the conversation has really changed around here. And I do think that's something that's much more likely to happen now than ever before.
Tracy, I appreciate your call from Oklahoma City. I want to bring one more voice in here. Heidi, stand by there. Harold Brooks joins us from Norman, Oklahoma. He's research meteorologist at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's National Severe Storms Laboratory in Norman. We've spoken before. Harold Brooks, welcome back to On Point. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Tom. It's good to be back.
You heard our caller, Tracy, there in Oklahoma City saying, look, it feels like tornadoes are getting stronger, more fierce. You know, we remember F2s and F3s almost fondly now. F5s have got her attention. What's the evidence? Are tornadoes actually strengthening over time, or is it just what Moore has run into in the last 15 years?
There's no evidence to suggest that the tornadoes have gotten stronger over the years. When we look at the records, that we just don't see any trends of changes in the intensity of tornadoes.
We saw in 2011 this epic year for tornadoes in Tornado Alley. Not so much in Oklahoma, maybe, but certainly in the Southeast. Have we seen years of higher frequency of tornadoes, Harold, or not?
Well, we've seen years of higher frequency and years of lower frequency. There's a suggestion that there's an increase in the variability of the occurrence of tornadoes. If we look, for instance, in just the last 3 years and restrict our attention to the F1 and greater tornadoes, so eliminate the weakest tornadoes, the F0s, from the conversation, and we look at any 12-month period, we find that the record over the last 60 years, the most tornadoes in a 12-month period occurred from June of 2010 to May of 2011 with 1,050, but also the record low of 217 occurred from May of last year through April of this year. So we actually set the record for the most and the fewest in the last 3 years.
Along the coast, people are looking at hurricanes. They're thinking about oceans rising. They're thinking about climate change that may lead to more severe storms. But you're suggesting that notion of a climate change-induced more severe tornado profile is not borne out by the evidence at this point.
That's correct. And in fact, our physical expectations, we aren't completely sure what's going to happen with tornadoes. One of the ingredients as the planet warms that's related to the temperature, which is essentially the moisture that will be available, the energy available for storms, that will likely become more favorable for tornadoes. But an important ingredient, the organization of the storms, the wind shear, the change of the winds with height in the atmosphere that the storm forms in, that's going to decrease as we go forward into the future. And we've got some evidence that it's decreased slightly over the last 60 years. And as a result, the balance is hard to tell what's going to happen. Tornadoes are particularly sensitive to the wind shear term. And so our best estimates right now is we shouldn't expect to see a really big change in tornado occurrence. And we really can't tell what's going to happen with the intensity changes, if there'd be any at all. but that the given the and given how much variability, even in a relatively constant climate, we see, it'll be very hard to detect any changes in the trends.
So you look at a pattern, or that Moore's had a pattern. I don't know. They had huge in 99, huge this week. If you're in Tornado Alley and you're trying to figure out whether to invest in strengthening structures, and you look at the odds of being hit by a tornado in any given municipality or locale, how do you think about that? If you're standing, you know, in position X in Oklahoma, what's your chance of being hit by a tornado over 20 years, Harold?
Well, your chances actually are pretty low for any particular point to be hit by a tornado. We estimate that roughly at any single point in this part of the country, you'd expect to get hit by an F2 tornado about once every 4,000 years. And so the chances of actually your spot of land getting hit are very, very small. Moore has obviously been incredibly unlucky, and that appears to just be really bad luck and not any particular thing about Moore. And so when I think about the problem, I've actually thought about the problem in a very practical way. When my wife and I did an addition onto our house, the walk-in shelter, we have a walk-in closet that's a reinforced concrete shelter.
So once in 4,000 years, but at your house, there's a storm shelter.
Well, and I wouldn't have done it as retrofitting. I only did it when we were already doing an $80,000 addition onto the house. So adding $2,000 to the cost is, you know, $5 a month on the cost of the loan.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Oklahoma's giant twister, and whether Tornado Alley needs to change the way it builds, re-engineer in the face of big, big storms. Harold Brooks is with us from NOAA's National Severe Storms Laboratory in Norman, Oklahoma. Heidi Brandis is here from Oklahoma City, longtime journalist there, and in Moore, right next door, was editor of the Moore American in 99, the big tornado hit, reporting out of there this week for the Wall Street Journal. Here's a CBS News tape from this week in Moore, Oklahoma.
She called me and she was like, well, the house is gone. And I just started crying because I didn't know what, like, how to take it. I was just like, wow, this really just happened.
We were pulling walls off of people. There were people crawling out from everywhere and anywhere.
It's just terrible. It's so bad. I can't even believe I'm still alive.
The whole country paying attention. In New York, New York Mets pitcher Jeremy Hefner, born and raised in Moore, Oklahoma, said you learn what to do when a tornado hits.
A tornado with 200-mile-an-hour winds, I mean, you hope that you're underground. You know, you don't want to be inside your house. Hopefully you find a place underground because that's the safest place.
Underground, if you can be there. Here's former Oklahoma Governor Frank Keating. He was in office when Moore was hit last time with a big tornado in 1999. Told CBS News' Charlie Rose it's critical for people to have shelters at their homes.
Families like my daughter and son who live in Oklahoma City need to have a shelter, and both of our kids put one underneath their garage. It's not terribly expensive. They did it. But a lot of people just don't think things are going to happen, bad things to happen to somebody else down the street.
Somebody down the street, some other school, but this week, children dead at school, and that really hurts. Damian Klein, fourth grader at Plaza Towers Elementary School, survived. Hiding out in a bathroom with other teachers and students, his mother spent an hour wondering if he was still alive. In an interview with NBC, she asked why the school didn't have a better shelter plan.
I definitely think every school in Oklahoma should have an underground shelter. So it shouldn't take a tornado this size and this many kids hurt, missing, and lost their lives to realize that they need underground shelters.
Heidi Brandis, next door in Oklahoma City, why didn't this school have a shelter? And what is the policy in Moore and beyond in Oklahoma about what schools have them and which don't?
There was some funding after the big 1999 tornado for shelters in school, reinforced shelters in schools. But again, like most things, funding wasn't enough. Just talking for myself, for instance, I don't have a shelter at my house. I know a lot of people who don't have in-ground tornado shelters, and it's mainly due to the cost. I mean, yeah, sure, you can get some tax incentives, things like that, to help offset that cost, but right now, I mean, my neighbor, myself, a lot of people I know, it's just too expensive to install those. So for those people who are living, you know, paycheck to paycheck, who are, you know, struggling to make the bills meet, I mean, it's not practical to for them at the moment, until a tornado happens, to have an in-ground storm shelter. They can't afford it.
Well, boy,
in fact, I talked to a lady yesterday who his home was destroyed by the 1999 tornado. Her name is Debbie Bird. She moved further south in Moore, and her new neighborhood was mostly those displaced by the 1999 tornado, but she was the only one on her block that had a reinforced tornado shelter built inside her home. So again, even those who have lost their homes still, you know, sometimes it's just the cost is the deciding factor.
Human nature and economics and people thinking about the odds. Harold Brooks,
yeah.
I mean, you're our storm expert, Harold, and there you are. Yes, it's just $5 a month, and a lot of people don't do it. But you've got, even though the odds are as low as they are, you've got that shelter in your home. Why, Harold, when you know the odds?
It's primarily for peace of mind. And if I'm not at home, I mean, we've been into that shelter as a family. Probably it's been used, I think, four times, two of which I was not at home, and one of the third ones I didn't think we needed to go in there anyway. But I lost that argument. It's not really that common of an event. And one of the things also, we made the decision to have our shelter above ground. And that was based on the fact that on the May 3rd tornado, there was a gentleman who was killed getting into a shelter that ended up being 3 miles from the path. He was in a wheelchair, and he was dropped going down the steps. And that we realized, my wife and I realized, that there may come a point in our life where going down four set of stairs may make it very, very difficult to do that. And so we decided we would have it on the living level of the house.
Yeah.
And that, you know, I can be in bed and then into the shelter within 30 seconds. And that's not a real big issue for us. We could get a wheelchair into that shelter.
Right, if you needed to. But let me ask you this. You're the storm expert. I don't quite understand these above-ground shelters. They're mostly made out of cement, maybe some steel. But when we see big horses and SUVs and trucks thrown around by a big tornado, why wouldn't your shelter just be tossed somewhere? Same way.
Well, I mean, my shelter is 6-inch reinforced concrete with the reinforcing bar every 4 inches. If my concrete guy, who when he was pouring it, said, "Can I come to your house?" And basically that I think about the only way my shelter goes is if a tractor trailer or a train car hits it. And if that point, you know, that's such an incredibly rare event that it's not going to be a real problem. I mean, these shelters have survived. There were shelters I'm sure there were shelters given the fact that FEMA had paid for a large number of shelters that were in the path of this tornado. And there were over 100 people taken out of shelters. I'm sure there were above ground shelters that survived the tornado on Monday.
I really appreciate you being with us today, Harold. Harold Brooks at the National Severe Storms Laboratory in Norman, Oklahoma. Good luck to you, and thanks for joining us, Harold.
You're welcome.
And Heidi Brandis reporting on the Moore tornado out of Oklahoma City with us today. Heidi, thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Here's Oklahoma Governor Mary Fallon. This was yesterday on NBC's Today Show, saying the storm this week, the tornado, the worst she's seen, the worst just destruction in her 23 years in public office.
I've been through the May 3rd tornado. I was here when the April 19th bombing hit Oklahoma City, destroyed the federal building. To me, this is bigger than anything I've ever seen. It's absolutely huge. It's horrific.
And here, an unidentified Moore resident talking with NBC News.
It ripped open the door, and it just glass and debris started slamming on us. And we thought we were dead, to be honest.
We're looking at Oklahoma's giant twister and whether Tornado Alley needs to change the way it builds, re-engineer maybe in the face of big storms. With us right now from Springfield, Missouri is Jeff Barber, architect, housing, environmental design specialist at the University of Missouri's Extension Service. He was a consultant to Joplin, Missouri after the 2011 tornado there, advised on tornado-proofing the infrastructure and community preparedness policies. Construction phase architect for the first FEMA community storm shelter in Missouri after the 2003 Pierce City tornadoes destroyed nearly the entire town there. Jeff Barber in Missouri, thank you very much for joining us today.
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
Very well. Really thinking about all those people in this, on the block after block of more in trouble. And in the studio with me, Jeff, say hi to Mike Fitzgerald. Michael Fitzgerald, just weeks before the tornado in Moore, he wrote a series of articles about national disaster preparedness that included a look at Moore, Oklahoma. We've got links to it at our website, onpointradio.org. Michael Fitzgerald with me here in Boston. Thanks for joining us.
Great to be here. Hi, Tom.
You've just been out in Oklahoma recently. Were people worried, before it hit, or was it just, well, no, we're all right, tornadoes go where they go?
There's more of that latter attitude. I wasn't actually physically in Oklahoma, but the people that I interviewed there and in places like Joplin, Missouri, and in mm-hmm. Alabama, where mm-hmm. they'd had the big tornadoes in 2011, there's a kind of sense of fatalism about it. They're going to happen. We don't know where they're going to happen. We don't know how big they're going to be. We can't, you know, we have to go on living.
Jeff Barber, as you've watched more Oklahoma this week and seen the destruction there, and how are you responding? I mean, some of it looks like there's just no way you could harden all the infrastructure. The ferocity, the intensity looks so great. But are you seeing things that could have, might have, should have been done that would have saved lives, saved property?
Sure. You have, you know, just so much debris and wind energy being released in these events. And so, you know, the shear that our previous guest was talking about, just the wind cutting across the ground, is substantial, but also the uplift. And so really understanding the forensics of how buildings come apart during windstorms is really important. And then what we can do, as if you kind of put that in reverse, how you can stop or slow that down or resist it as best that you can. And, you know, moreover, you can't really create buildings that are 100% tornado proof. But what we can do is start to kind of use a castle mentality, you know, that there are certain areas that you can afford to reinforce to maximum life protection, and then there are other areas that you can't, and so you do some things that would minimize damage in a lesser tornadic event.
Let's start with schools here, because that's where we saw this terrible toll of kids this week, and that's where you don't want to have to worry. You want to think that there's someplace, a school, that would be safe. We've got people calling in on that front from Oklahoma, Stillwater, Oklahoma. Dave's calling. Hi, Dave. Thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. What do you see?
Well, shortly after there were 2 days of tornadoes. There was one previous to more that tore up areas of around Shawnee, Oklahoma.
Yes.
So the conditions were the same. People had a lot of notification about this tornado. But in that light, the superintendent of our schools in Stillwater let everybody know that there are two schools that are being built in Stillwater. And because of the situation in Oklahoma, they're incorporating reinforced steel and concrete hallways that will allow 1,200 students or 1,200 people, which will take all of the students, staff, and everyone in the school to go into these areas. They have doors that shut on both ends, so they're actually a very secure area that's large enough for everyone to get into. They're built to withstand an F5, not tornado, but a hurricane. It's very hard, I guess, to decide if you can withstand an F5 tornado. But they've done everything they can to incorporate that into the schools. And I think going forward that it's no question to do that in our schools and try to retrofit wherever we can.
Dave, I'm glad you've got that coming there in Stillwater. I'm sure a lot of people will be thinking about that in the wake of what we just saw. I mean, you know, they're talking about kids being told to just sit with a backpack or a math book over their head or put on their football helmet. That is not enough. This was from NBC News yesterday, Brian Williams asking the Weather Channel's Jim Cantore about safe rooms and what the region may need to do.
If we're going to put our kids in a hall and teach them how to crouch and hold their hands over their head, we have to have a place that's not going to be blown apart. We have to have buildings that can sustain the type of damage that they're used to here, obviously. We're talking about 200-mile-per-hour winds. So that's the first thing, and obviously a big thing we need to address. People's homes. I was down in Tuscaloosa, as were you, and after the 27 April 2011 outbreak, we saw them build back Habitat for Humanity homes for $75,000 with safe rooms, with safe rooms in them. So this is not an undoable thing.
Jeff Barber in Springfield, Missouri. Let's go first to schools and the path of a tornado, and might as well make it a big one because that's what we saw this week. Can you put together a shelter that will withstand and keep safe the population of a good-sized school in a way that's fail-proof, Jeff, or not?
Well, the best option that we have, and you know, there's no 100% assurance, but the best option that we have is a guideline put together by FEMA called the FEMA 321 guideline, 361 guideline design, and construction guidance for community safe rooms. And it's not a building code, but it is a series of guidelines that, if followed, will give a pretty high level of certainty. In our work that we did with the first storm shelter in Pierce City, we actually went in and designed that thing for the 200 mile per hour, 3 second gust. It's a heavy building. I think the building itself weighed over 3 million pounds. Then the doors and so on, I mean, each door cost about $5,000, weighed about 250 pounds, just the leaf itself. You know, there were some substantial aspects to that could be incorporated into these. One thing I would indicate about the schools, and, you know, a lot of these older schools, they're only allowed to call those hallways now a tornado refuge, because mm-hmm. they're really not much more than just a few hardened walls. And that might make it through your F1, maybe F2 tornado. But, you know, the walls typically aren't reinforced if they are masonry. And, you know, usually you have glass doors at the end of the hall, so it really becomes more of a wind tunnel, flying debris, and so on. And so if there are some design aspects that are thought about, labyrinth design, in other words, mm-hmm. so that debris that would be blowing would have to turn a corner, for instance, that begins to take some of the energy out and some of the danger out. So, you know, can we do it? The answer is yes. Do we have the will to do it? I'd say probably so. I know in Southwest Missouri, we're approaching, I believe, 50 storm shelter, community storm shelter type structures now, and school districts do frequently seek out this funding like we did in Pierce City with the first one. In Pierce City, it was part of a firehouse and actually ended up being the gap financing needed for, if you can think about it, the fourth wall
mm-hmm.
of it. So, mm-hmm. you know, it did give an opportunity to help fund the reconstruction of a firehouse and provide a shelter that was for the people within a five-minute walk.
If you've got 5 minutes. Michael Fitzgerald, in your reporting, did you find town leaders ready to spend on this or reluctant when there's always a lot of demands, there's never enough money, and who knows if the twister's coming or not?
Well, you don't know, and you have a lot of other things that you have to juggle. I mean, I went into this series thinking it would be a no-brainer that towns should require storm shelters, and I came out of it thinking that, you know, it's not such a no-brainer. If you're comparing what developers want, you know, and they'll argue that any $1,000 increase in their cost is going to change any slight increase in their cost is going to change the cost of the house. It's going to limit the market. And in a state like Oklahoma with a median income of $43,000, you know, those numbers do start to make you wonder. And, you know, in Joplin, Jeff, you talked with them. You know, they didn't require storm shelters. They added some other structural requirements.
Even
for
after all that
homes,
devastation.
But they didn't require storm shelters to be put in. And they didn't do it there in part, the guy who runs emergency management told me, Keith Stammer, because they have a high water table and they have really rocky ground. And so it actually makes it difficult to build shelters in a lot of areas.
Underground shelters.
To build underground shelters, yeah.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about Oklahoma's giant twister this week and whether Tornado Alley, and of course that goes across a huge swath of this country, needs to change the way it builds, re-engineer in the face of big, big storms. It's a question that Hurricane Sandy, Superstorm Sandy, put in the face of a lot of coastal residents in this country. It's a question that Florida and other hurricane-prone zones have wrestled with for a long time. Storms in Joplin, the big 2011 outbreak, this week's storm in Moore, Oklahoma, are raising the question again. Jeff Barber is with us from Springfield, Missouri today. He's done a lot of advising, environmental design specialist there at the University of Missouri's Extension Service, done a lot of advising on how to build to be safer. Michael Fitzgerald is with me in the studio, independent journalist. He's done a big series on preparedness, national disaster preparedness, included a look at Moore, Oklahoma. You can link to that at our website, onpointradio.org. Jeff Barber, let me ask you just something very simple here. I mean,
I grew up in tornado country. This was in Prairie, Illinois country, and we were down in the cellar, the fruit cellar plenty. My grandmother would get us down there, you know, at the littlest hint of a tornado coming. I remember many, many days waiting, you know, can we get out of here yet? The idea was you had a cellar or a fruit cellar or a backyard old-fashioned storm cellar, shelter, where you'd go. I mean, it was right there in Wizard of Oz, and it wasn't just fiction. What happened to those, Jeff? Did people stop building them at some point? Did we lose some old folk wisdom along the way?
Well, I think so. You know, part of that was those cellars were there for food preservation and served a dual purpose as far as storm protection.
Potatoes down there for the winter.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, in kind of the conventional Midwest wisdom is if that's what you got, that's what you got. But, you know, the problem that we run into is, like our previous guest had talked about, is the ability to, as we age, change levels. I think another very significant component of our population these days, particularly in the Midwest, is veterans. They have a great survival rate, so they come back. They may have injuries that impair their mobility. And because of that, the prospect of having to go outdoors or change levels even within the home is problematic. So we really need to work towards storm shelters that, if possible, safe rooms, if possible, can be above grade, basically walk-in, roll-in type arrangements. And that goes for public buildings as well as our private buildings as well.
Michael, you've done a lot of reporting on this. One of our listeners here writes, look to nature for the answer. The prairie dog got it right. Go underground. But Jeff's reminding us, you got people who can't make that. Of course, Auntie M ran across the back of the farmyard and got down there, but some people can't these days. But what about the underground? What did you find on the underground front, Michael?
Well, as long as it's well built, you know, it is going to be more secure. It is the debris that kills most people with high wind storms like tornadoes. Yeah. Jeff, correct me if I'm wrong, but unless you've got a 6-inch thick concrete fortified closet like Harold was mentioning, they probably don't really survive an F5, and they certainly don't survive one like the one that hit Moore in 99. That had 300-mile-an-hour winds.
Right. What you're really working against here is kind of grammar school nursery rhyme. You know, is it the straw of the house, the stick house, or the brick house that survives the big wind?
Yeah.
You know, and it's really simple physics. It's the force that's involved and the mass that you have to resist that. And the FEMA 320 guideline for building the safe room in your home actually addresses that and has tested assemblies that are tested up through, I believe, EF4, and some of them that actually get into the actual concrete and reinforced, heavily reinforced masonry would potentially, if they're tied down correctly, be able to get into that EF5 category.
What's it cost to put a shelter like that in your home at ground level, Jeff?
Yeah, according to FEMA, they're looking at roughly between $6,000 to $8,000. You know, that sounds like a lot of money until you look at the options that you have for floor covering in a house, or in Midwest, how much does somebody spend on a gun safe or something like that?
Yeah, of course, it's also it's taking up space in the house. It's not going to be your gun room if it's of course, it could be your shelter and your gun room. What do you think, Michael?
So there are a couple things that came up when I was talking to people, and one was, you know, looking as a community at the risks you face. And so, most people, they're even in a bad year like 2011, about 600 people died in tornadoes across the country. More than that die every week in car accidents. So do you as a community invest your risk dollars towards something that's going to happen to on a far greater basis? Not as dramatic, obviously. Much more lower grade, doesn't kill as many people.
You mean individual automobile accidents?
Individual automobile accidents. I mean, 15,000 people a year to 40,000 people a year. I mean, the numbers are much, much, much larger than storms. And so do you put in extra stoplights? So there's some practical concerns there.
Yeah.
Another thing that got raised with underground shelters in public, at least in public spaces, which sound, again, like, of course you do this. Does it then become something that people in the community leave their homes to go to, putting themselves actually at greater risk
on their way to the shelter?
Yeah.
Let's get a call from Oklahoma, Stillwater, Oklahoma. James is calling. Hi, James. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Very well. I'm okay. And thinking about you guys there, what do you see?
Well, one of the things that struck me is, and has been a little overlooked, unfortunately, due to the tragedy, is that a couple who had just moved here and lived on the second floor of an apartment building. And they evacuated, but had no place to go, and ended up surviving the storm by laying down in a ditch outside.
Wow.
So part of this whole push to personal responsibility and installing storm shelters in homes is great and everything, and changing building codes for crying homes to do so.
Yeah.
But what about those of us that live in rental communities?
No kidding. Lots of apartment buildings all over Tornado Alley. Jeff, how do you take responsibility? You can't exactly shove a secure room into an apartment that you're renting. So
right.
What happens there? That's a lot of people, Jeff.
Well, I think what we've done is we've broken into another topic, which is the split incentive involved in terms of the builders and developers of these multifamily or even duplexes, for that matter. People are investing in these homes, and they don't have an immediate return on investment or may never have a return on investment from safe room upgrades, and so that becomes a problem, and the caller is exactly right. I mean, if it's another type that we have here is sometimes a mobile home park or something where these people are completely vulnerable. They can't shelter in place. They have to go to some sort of community shelter. So the question becomes, do we as a community have the resolve to put requirements on those people that are making a profit from people living there, but in no way compelled to provide protection for them? So, we really need to look at, in some ways, what we can do beyond a competitive advantage for those investors to provide maybe alternative funding mechanisms, whether it's, the government grants. But, moreover than that, maybe there's programs that you can borrow, but it isn't paid back except for, maybe over a 20-year period, kind of like a fire district assessment or sewer district assessment.
I mean, business comes in here in a hurry. Michael Fitzgerald, I think it was in an article that you wrote, I read, it could have been someone else's, about Joplin and how after the terrible devastation in Joplin in 2011, they're rebuilding and they wanted to bring in new, tougher code, but developers were against it because they thought, that will make the new buildings safer and make the old buildings less desirable and so cut into their ability to sell and rent those old properties. And so they were stuck.
There's a perception of that. I have actually talked to an economist about values when you have storm shelters. And there's no good data on whether it affects overall housing values. But it does actually improve slightly the value of your house if you have one of these shelters. But there is this perception, and the perception is more powerful than the data itself. And so that did come up in some of the public debate there.
Some resistance in a hurry. Mike in Spencer, West Virginia is calling. Hi, Mike. Thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. A big part of the solution can be earth-sheltered housing, whereas the whole house is actually a shelter. It could withstand an F5. It needs no air conditioning. It needs very little heat. You wouldn't know it's earth-sheltered from being in front of it or inside of it. We've been living in one for a year. I highly recommend it.
What is an earth-sheltered house, Mike? Is this your prairie dog house? Is this an underground house, or what is it?
Well, you don't need a ladder to get down to it. The entire front is open to the weather. Earth sheltered, people think underground, but earth is bermed on the roof and on the sides and on the back, and the only part that is facing is the front.
Okay, so that's getting back to real old style plains construction. Jeff Barber, how about it? Maybe we need to bring some of that back.
Well, I don't know that folks are ready to go out and put a for sale sign or buy an old soddy house, but the pioneers, they had to respond again with what they had. That was what they had, and so you saw kind of a type develop out of that was storm resistant, but moreover, it was part of just being comfortable in that space. So, I think that the caller is correct, though, in the sense that we can learn from that and maybe begin to integrate some of those aspects in, but expecting that there be some sort of a market saturation or so on. When houses in Oklahoma City are supposed to look like houses in California or Boston, for that matter, it just is kind of a hard thing to expect the market to do that. And I think it does get back to some of the financial incentives that are there in terms of split incentives. And, you know, additionally, this is a unique community, or not unique, I should say, in the sense that it is a bedroom community to both Norman, Oklahoma to the south and Oklahoma City to the north. And so sometimes that can compromise the community's resolve for issues because they're worried about work in Oklahoma City or something else. And,
yeah.
You know, the last thing that they think about at night before they go to bed maybe is more Oklahoma or their communities.
Well, so. I mean, you may expect a subdivision to look a certain way and want to build to that image. On the other hand, the images we've seen out of Moore this week just flattened block after block. Nobody wants that. Justin in Lexington, Kentucky. Justin, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, hi, Tom.
Hi.
I was actually calling. I, you know, was listening to your program, and, you know, one of the questions that came to mind was, a community shelter that would kind of be centralized around, you know, different subdivisions or different, trailer parks or some of the more areas that are, more open to disasters, you know.
Yeah.
And also alternative methods. Alternative fundraising, I don't know if they could do it, but, you know, my wife's a teacher, and what if they asked for, the family to donate, let's say, $1 a year, everyone pitching $1, or churches, raising money or different things like that, because, I think it's kind of hard, this day and age, it's kind of hard to rely on the government to kind of come in and give you a personal shelter for every single person.
Well, I agree there. I guess the government would show up at the school level, the public institutions. It could show up at policy level if it wanted to support the building of these things. Michael, the economics of this, everybody's cash-strapped these days, but nobody wants to be the one who sees nine children in their community.
You can make a reasonable economic. There's an economist named Kevin Simmons at Austin College in Sherman, Texas, who studies the economics of things like what is it going to cost to publicly fund shelters. And so he looked at fatalities, what's it cost per fatality in a place like Oklahoma, and found that it would be about $4 million per fatality to require, if you required people to put in shelters. In Alabama, it would be like $10 million. But he said that where you start to see real return is for multi-unit residences and for mobile home parks, that it does make sense to require those there because they are so much more prone to having devastating numbers of people being killed.
Luann in Hampton Roads, Virginia. Luann, thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me today. Listen, I want to just, first of all, give our hearts and prayers to everyone in Oklahoma here from Virginia today.
Yes.
We're thinking of you and sending a lot of people out to help. I wanted to comment, Tom, on exactly what everyone's been talking about on your program, which is phenomenal. Thank you so much for that because it's on everyone's mind out here in the nation.
Sure.
Not only since it happened, but subsequently to that. Having worked on commissions of types in different counties, my husband also works out of the Pentagon, and one of his he's a committee member for looking at climate and what's happening within the climate and all the shifts we're seeing. And everyone's made so many wonderful points today, but one of the best results of research is what we see in Moore itself. Since the actual horrible tornado of 1999 and all that happened to rebuild, what do we see? Out of that particular study and what happened in that devastation, we see one elementary school, which has got everyone up in arms without the place to go, and one that did. And that is actually the answer. We have to have answers to what we know from research, and how do we get that? Well, usually a disaster happens in America before we get to that answer. And we do it in the United States military. We find what does and does not work within a system of defense. And what do? We go after that next best thing. Same is true of communities. Not only do we have to look at what's best in our own community and the corners of the country that we live, and I've lived in every corner of this country. My husband, also former Air Force. We've lived in the Tornado Alley. I'm a seventh-generation Floridian, and I've lived through many disastrous hurricanes. What have we learned from the hurricane in South Miami in the early 90s, Hurricane Andrew?
Luann, I think I got the point. Where the disasters come, and they get our attention in a big way, and then the question is what we do about it. And, Jeff, we have the sense of living in times when some of these physical challenges are becoming greater.
And sometimes the sense or the question of whether we have the economic wherewithal to really respond fully to the risks that are out there, or whether we're just going to be put in harm's way and that's the way it goes. How do you look at that, Jeff, in this time?
Well, it's hard to put a price tag on life. And I think that, you know, you also have to deal with the in-betweens. I can remember being a graduate student at Norman, Oklahoma, in the early 90s, and, you know, any time that the sirens would go off, I mean, it was almost a nightly event in May where...
The tornado warning.
Oh, all the time.
Yeah,
all the time.
Sure.
And so if you want to live in a constant state of fear, that stresses somebody, and that's going to have an impact on your life. And so, you know, in a situation like this, it is a matter of personal comfort and assurance, as well as personal safety. And so, you know, we need to consider that. We need to have our appraisers begin to put this into the formula for the value of a home and actually make it a selectable criteria whenever we're looking for homes, particularly in the Midwest. I mean, anywhere from the Rocky Mountains over to the Appalachians and the Great Lakes down to the Gulf, we have a very high impact zone for severe and catastrophic tornadoes. So
value life, you're going to value that shelter. Jeff, we're up against the clock here. Jeff Barber at the University of Missouri Extension Service. Thank you very much, Jeff.
You bet.
And Michael Fitzgerald with me in the studio. Thanks so much for coming in, Michael.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.